ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
This is the NT Country Hour on ABC Radio Darwin and the Northern Territory.
Good afternoon, Northern Territory. My name's Charles Geary, and welcome to the Country Hour. Now, just before we started today's program, Chief Minister Leah Fenocchiaro put out a statement saying the government rejects a one-size-fits-all approach to gun control. Northern Territory Country Hour executive producer Tom Robinson is in the studio to explain what they're disagreeing over.
Thanks, Charles. The issue seems to be who is going to pay for it. So the Australian is reporting that it will cost $1 billion to run this gun buyback scheme. And there was a standing council of attorneys general and police ministers meeting last Friday. And it's basically the briefings that are coming to the journalists out of this meeting is that this $1 billion will be split 50-50 between the states, territories, as one 50, and then the other 50 being the federal government. And the Tasmanian government has already come out and said that they expect the Commonwealth to pay, and now it looks like the Northern Territory government has joined in and said that as well. So Chief Minister Leah Fenocchiaro said the Northern Territory does not support a national gun buyback scheme that is funded by Territorians. She says if the federal government wants to put a national buyback scheme in place, they should fund it. I, the Chief Minister, will not have everyday Territorians foot that bill. She says there needs to be a measured approach to ensure reforms are genuinely needed, relevant and appropriate to each jurisdiction. She says she respects the rights of governments like New South Wales who have gone right ahead. They recalled Parliament shortly after the attack in Bondi to put gun reform on the legislative agenda. She says, yeah, we respect the New South Wales government right to do that, but there cannot be a one-size-fits-all approach. And that the government will continue to work with the federal government to fast-track the National Firearms Register and allow additional use of criminal intelligence to reject or remove firearms licences.
Tom, thank you for coming in today and giving us that update on that disagreement between the Territory government and the Commonwealth on a proposed government a gun buy-back scheme. Well, not proposed, it was announced today by the Prime Minister.
ABC Local Radio. We're live. Local and ad-free wherever you are. Download the ABC Listen app and listen now.
Today marks a pretty special day for the Hayes family, with the today being the 30th anniversary of their move out to the Garden Station. The Garden Station is about 70 kilometres northeast of Alice Springs as the crows fly. And the neighbours and the Hayes family also own the neighbouring property, another major property, Undulia Station. I spoke to the Garden Station's Andy Hayes to learn more about his 30 years on the pastoral lease.
Bloody old, I suppose. No, it's a... well, the Hayes haven't gone very far in the last 150-odd years. So I suppose we're going to stay at the Garden for a while too.
When was it that you acquired this station, and why did the Hayes take on the Garden Station?
Well, we took on the Garden. It came up for auction on about November, I think, of 95, and we ended up getting it out of auction. It wasn't in the auction. We bought it after. There was, and then Jane and I and Katie and Steve moved out here in January. 12th of January in 96. We bought it because Undulia was that dry, and the family had been at Undulia for a long time, and Undulia was that dry. We needed a bit of feed. Not that there was much more feed here, but there was a little bit more than what we had at Undulia. So we bought it, and then within weeks of coming out here, we brought out about 300 Undulia steers at the start, and then we just kept bringing cattle out here.
You mentioned that you moved over to the station just to escape some of that dry weather down there at Undulia. What were your first impressions when you arrived out at the Garden?
I don't know. It was a pretty place. It's a really beautiful place out here. It's a very picturesque. It's hard country, but it's good country. There's always a pocket of feed around somewhere, and it's. Yeah, Jane and I were lucky enough to get the gig to come out here and look after it.
How has the Garden Station changed over the years? 30 years is a long time. How's it changed over those 3 decades?
Well, 30 years ago, we walked most of the cattle out of the hills because you didn't have a choice. If you weren't walking the cattle out, we had an under your body truck with one trailer, and that would cart all your weaners out, but that was a mammoth task. So these days, we've had cattle charmers out here for the last 10-odd years, might be a bit longer, 12 years, and he's put in roads. He started with a Komatsu. He ended up with a D10, a Caterpillar D10, and he's opened this country right up. We can get a road train, 4 decks, I suppose, not a 6-deck unit, but we can get 4 decks over just about all of the place now. So, you know, that's come a long way. 30 years ago, we used to be in the camp for the whole muster, apart from what the paddocks around the house. These days, you know, the furthest bore run, or the furthest bore out now, is, you know, sort of less than an hour from the house. So, you know, we've come home at night, the girls cook a feed for the fellas, and or for the people, not fellas anymore, it's all girls and boys in the camp, and they have a good sleep back at the house in the wintertime, and back into it again next morning. But there's been some big changes like that. Communication, like I'm sitting out here on a bore run talking to you now. You know, if it was 30 years ago, we wouldn't have been having this conversation, but we had one phone on the property, or two phones on the property in the houses, one in the quarters and one in our house. But yeah, the one in the quarters didn't last very long, and so we were, people were lining up to use the phone during the week, or once a week, or whenever they were home, to talk to family and friends wherever.
Some might say, for better or worse, that now the journalists can call you halfway through your bore run.
But yeah, that's right.
I imagine broadly these improvements have really improved in quality of life out there and made it easier to run that station.
Yeah, well, it's a big change. There's no doubt about it. You know, we used to do a lot of bloody man hours where you cut your man hours back a bit. We're still doing full days. I don't know. The time doesn't change, but you're still getting things done, but just in a different way for sure. And it's a lot easier, like you say. And probably, go back to the start when we had sort of, five or six blokes plus Benny and Richie and my old man. Like that. So, you know, we had a fairly big camp, mustering both places, mustering here and Undelia. And now you're down to 3 or 4.
Just for those who are a bit unfamiliar with the Garden Station, what does it look like today? What's the country, I guess, looking like after what's been a bit of a dry spell in Central Australia the last few weeks?
It has. Before Christmas, it wasn't, we were, sort of late November, early December, we were looking pretty good going into the summer. And but then the rain sort of stopped, and the wind here has been unbelievable at the moment, and it's been pretty warm and drying the country out like you wouldn't believe. We're just flat out shifting cattle off of dams and bores. It's pretty normal for a dry year like we're having at the moment for sure. But cattle are still good. Cattle are bloody, they're carrying their condition well.
One other thing we have to touch on is that the garden does neighbour onto Undulia Station, where the rest of the Hayes family is. How important has that proximity to family been for you and the Hayes family?
Oh, that's that speaks tenfold. That because it's you got Undulia just there. Within the first 12 months of being here, we put a we got the dozer and put a road in between Undulia and the garden on a bore run. So there's a lot of gear that was shifted backwards and forwards. A lot of cattle went along that road, either in the truck or walking them. And it was just a game changer straight away. So we were sharing gear, I suppose. We had a lot of gear to share, and sharing it back then, so it was good.
Andy, congrats on the 30 years out there at the Garden Station, and thanks for joining us on the NT Country Hour today.
No worries at all, and I'd just like to say thanks to everyone that give us a hand to get to where we are. There's been a lot of people involved and a lot of great people that have helped us too.
That was the Garden Station's Andy Hayes. He was speaking about his 30 years at the Garden Station. Now, time for a song, and I think it's time for this absolute gem of a track. Get caught, That was Ryan Storing Cowboy by Glen Campbell.
G'day, I'm Toby. I'm Cotton Dinner in Northern Territory. You're listening to The Country Hour.
My name is Charles Skeery. If you're just joining us, this is the NT Country Hour. Time is just about to hit 15 to 1. Now, since recovering from a helicopter crash that almost claimed his life in 2015, Catherine Pilot and Butcher, Matt Gain, has been finding success in whatever he puts his hand to. Last time ABC Rules spoke with him, Matt was running a solo mobile butchering operation from Catherine, but his latest project is much bigger, involves some of the town's most innovative and enterprising. With help from regenerative farmer Jeremy Trembath and well-known Catherine businessman Nino Nisafararu, Matt's now the face of a paddock-to-plate beef concept that's been decades in the making.
I'm Matt Gain, helicopter pilot. I was mustering helicopter pilot here in Catherine. That's why I came here to Catherine 13 years ago, and butcher by trade, and now I'm back at the hands on the tools again, back in the butchering.
Why have you gone into butchery full-time again, and what's this latest venture you're doing?
You know, I always did do a bit of butchering, and after my crash in 2015, I started up my own mobile butchering thing around the town, and, you know, that sort of really took off. And then just to make it a bit more fixed, and, you know, I had a Nino Nisfora approach me about a few different ideas that he had and things, and we collaborated them all together, and I've designed this facility here, and Jeremy Trembath's built it, like just a little two-man slaughtering show over the last couple of years at least, and now we lease the whole facility, and Jeremy still has a fair bit to do with it.
So you're working with Nino on this venture. There's kind of two parts to it. Could you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, so Nino's dream, when he approached me last year, actually rang me. I was flying turbine helicopters over in the Torres Strait, hauling crayfish from islands across back to the mainland, or back to Thursday Island to the main base, and Nino rang me, and I said, oh, I was just flying. He said, oh, give me a call later that afternoon when I had a bit of time, and so I rang him, and then he told me about this venture and how he had these plans and dreams and all that stuff, and yeah, it's taken a while to grow, but I'd heard about the steakhouse. He'd bought the building, the old Outback Jack's building up there on Mitchell Street next to the Hilton, and to be asked by someone to help out with such a dream and put all my experience and knowledge of what I'm capable of into this venture, it's really something to be proud of.
So we're kind of at the midway point of the whole production line, I guess, where we're in the kill floor where the stock's been brought in. Where is it coming from and where does it go from here?
They're bred on King River and then they'll be weaned down there and either brought back here as weaners to Tyndall Downs, or they'll be weaned and go out into a paddock there, and then the following year they'll be brought back to Tyndall Grounds as a sort of a backgrounding phenomenon where we can easily grab them with a helicopter and bring them in and draft out the lead and put them on. Then they go on the pivots then to finish them off. We'll bring them here the day before we do them, and we'll draft out six or whatever we need to do, and then we'll bring them here the next day, the day before, and then the next day we'll come here at 7 o'clock in the morning and start slaughtering. Yeah.
And after here, it's going into your butcher shop. That's kind of a first for Catherine for a little while, isn't it, to have locally grown beef?
Yeah, absolutely, mate. I believe the last kill that was done here at the Catherine Meatworks was about 2001, from the stories I've been told. So, yeah, as far as I'm concerned, and to the best of my knowledge, there hasn't really been any beef killed locally here in Catherine and processed or done through the right way avenues since, 2001. So it's a pretty good thing for the town.
What kind of end product are you aiming for? Are you aiming for a certain specification when it comes to the meat, the marbling, or what's your ambition?
Yeah, there is a little bit like that. We're trying to at the moment. We're still a feeling in the dark process. Like, you know, we haven't really done this before with this particular breed. Like, and Nino, you know, he bought this breed here some 10 or 15 years ago, and people laughed at him that, you know, with the dreams and visions that he had. But he's created his own breed, which is Wagpole. So out of his Wagyu stud and his Centerpole stud, he's crossed the two. And he was telling me that no one else has done that breed. So he's actually put a thing in and registered that breed as Wagpole. And there's calves on the ground out there now at Tyndall Downs. And, yeah, they're beautiful, happy little fellas like that.
You spoke to ABC Rural about 10 years ago. It was just after you had a pretty serious helicopter accident. When you reflect on where you are now and where you were then, how does it feel to be here with this?
Oh, yeah, it's pretty amazing, eh? And, like, you know, there were times where I told I'd probably never fly a helicopter again after that crash. I was pretty messed up. But that was my number one goal for a long time, was to get back in the helicopter pilot seat. And that took me 3.5 years to get my medical back, and then did that, and then got back to flying. Then wasn't really sure how I wanted to do about it, but then proved it to myself, like, that I just wanted to do it. And, yeah, got really good at it again. And, yeah, that was really good. And then got this opportunity where it still allows me to fly. It still allows me, you know, muster a King River or muster Tyndall Downs, do all that in a helicopter. So I do all that and then still get to do everything all at once. So, you know, it's a contribution of everything that I've done, all of it right through, everything I've been trained on pretty well my whole life into one avenue. And, yeah, it's pretty good. It's pretty good to be able to utilise all those skills in one field and just keep in touch with your abilities.
I don't know how you do all of those things. You sound very multi-skilled. Are there any that you are really passionate about at the moment?
Oh, I'm very passionate about butchering and just providing the best possible product that I can to the customers at the end of the day. So, you know, every time they come into the shop, like, oh, I'm very friendly in the shop. It's a very friendly, wonderful atmosphere in there. The vibe that's in there, and then to be able to provide them with the produce or products that we're providing them with, and to have them come back and tell us how good it was and how much they enjoyed it, and to know that it comes from exactly here. They know where it all comes from. They're just, yeah, next level excited and happy too. And there's no greater feeling than that, like being able to, you know, look at the smile on their faces and knowing that you're delivering a genuine quality product.
That was Matt Gain there speaking with Sam Perry at a new micro abattoir on Lonesome Duck Estate, 4 kilometres north of Katherine.
Join your local ABC team when the sun rises each weekday. Our team is out in the community. We curate the news, weather and your local rural report. Join us for breakfast right here on ABC Local Radio.
National agribusiness giant Elders had a busy period in the Top End late last year. They've opened a new branch in Humpty Doo as they aim to expand their work into the horticulture sector in Darwin's rural area. Elders agronomist Callum Hutchinson spoke with Tom Robinson about their goals for 2026.
Elders are really looking to expand their horticultural footprint across the NT. Opening that branch in Humpty Doo was a massive step in that direction of being able to service all our clients across the whole of the NT, obviously with an existing branch down in Katherine. So really the idea, mate, was to be able to service our horticulture clients, whether they be mango growers, vegetable growers, melon growers, across the whole of the NT, and to be able to back up in-field advice with product in the shed, mate, so we can supply at the right times.
Was the decision based on, I guess, feedback or communication with the local growers, or was there sort of broader horticultural trends that were informing the thinking?
I think it was more to do with Elders having some existing business here, more so in the animal health and cattle space, and really realising that we weren't grasping the full potential of the NT, which was to also service horticulture growers. So my background being heavily in horticulture, been working in the NT for about 8 years now, and in horticulture as an agronomist for over 10 years now.
It's obviously a pretty quiet time of year just generally with the wet season and coming out of the Christmas New Year period. What sort of, I guess, inquiries or conversations are you having locally at this time of year?
Absolutely, mate. So we did start at a pretty tough time, sort of October 2025. So we were sort of towards the back end of the mango and vegetable melon season across the NT. Difficult time to start on the back foot a little bit, but at the same time, it gives us a really good opportunity now to plan for the 2026 season. Our main goal across, for the last few months and for the next couple of months coming up is just to make sure we're forecasting really well, start having those conversations with growers, start building those relationships, let them know what we have to offer. So making sure they're well prepared for the season coming up. There's a lot of planning that goes into making sure we have, you know, the right products at the right time, and to ensure that the growers get what they need when they need it. Mango growers have just sort of finished all their post-harvest activities. They put their fertilizer on. They're still going through and doing their hedging and their pruning, their termite treatments. So, yeah, mate, we're using this time just to make sure that we're talking with growers to make sure we're prepared for the coming season.
Any early indicators or forecasts you can shed light on at this stage for 2026?
Very early days, but we're getting some really good rain. So those aquifers are getting recharged, which is a really good first step, Tom. So, yeah, we're just going to have to wait and see. We really won't, speaking from, mango is one of my key passions. So if I talk about the mango industry, it's really early days. So we won't really start with more inducive flowering conditions until that sort of May-June period. But, yeah, while it's still hot, wet, humid, those mango trees are still very much in their reproductive, their vegetative mode. So they're storing all their reserves so they can come out and fire when the conditions are right. But, yeah, we're a little way off still knowing what those conditions are going to be like when we want to start looking at mango trees flowering. But we hope that when that time comes, we get some nice cool spells, that the ground dries out a little bit. And, yeah, hopefully that leads to a profuse flowering event. But we'll just have to wait and see on that one, mate.
You did mention, part of your thinking is to get elders engaged with the local horticulture and the fruit growing sort of sector here in the Territory. What would a successful 2026 look like from your point of view?
A successful 2026 will just be getting some grower awareness out there that we're here, we're operating, we're providing the best in-field service and advice, and we're backing that up with quality products. We've got everything that growers need, so get them walking through the door and get us out in the paddocks a bit more, really getting to know their operations, provided tailored results for any challenges that they may have. Yeah, we know that we're starting from the very beginning, so our expectations aren't too high, but, yeah, we do believe that we're going to be out there providing the best service and quality products to back that up. So, yeah, mate, just building traction slowly over the next few months and having a really good season and helping growers get some really good results for their 2026 growing season. That's going to be the main aim, and hopefully we just roll on from there.
Elders agronomist Callum Hutchinson, they've just opened a new branch in Humpty Doo, and he was chatting with Tom Robinson.
Rob Doyle here from Humpty Doo, Rambutan grower, and you're listening to the Country Hour.
My name's Charles Geary. If you've just joined us, this is the NT Country Hour. Time is just about to hit 3 minutes to one, and just before we head to the local weather after the hour, let's turn our eyes down south, where fires are burning through Victoria, with the conditions the worst they've been since Black Saturday in 2019. Now, the Victorian Farmers Federation have said that over 15,000 head of livestock have been lost to the fires. Those numbers are expected to rise. It was announced this morning that NT Fireys are heading down to help out. Liz Travaskis spoke with Acting Commander Andy Wharton on ABC Radio Darwin and the NT earlier this morning.
So we've got 34 members of the Northern Territory Fire and Emergency Services on their way. They left just after midnight last night. And that comprises an IMT or Incident Management Team component of 11 people. A strike force, strike team, so they're the firefighters that'll be on the ground in the front line, and we've got a jurisdictional liaison officer in there as well. So 34 all up on their way. In fact, they would have landed by now in Victoria.
How quickly did you get the call up that those firefighters were going to need a hand and you were able to put the call out locally?
Yeah, it came pretty quickly. It was pretty evident that they were going to exceed their capability at some point and need some bolstering. So we were sort of front foot on this. We'd have been planning for this a few days ago. So we were ready to take the call, and it was a really quick deployment. Credit to all of those that worked behind the scenes to get that happening. There's a lot of planning, a lot of work that goes into getting it to the point where we can put people on the aircraft.
Mm. And are they volunteer firefighters who are heading down, or are they, are they sort of the paid employed fireys from the Territory?
Yeah, look, the great part about this team is it's right across the board. So it's the first time as a standalone agency that we've sent a team from all three service arms. So we've got a mix of volunteers, we've got NTES, Bushfires NT, career firefighters, auxiliary and volunteer firefighters as well.
Now, Liz Travaskis also spoke to her father, Ian Travaskis, who's been on the ground fighting the fires near her hometown of Talangata over the weekend. She asked him what it's been like on the ground.
It's like, I think, everyone else up here. It's beginning to wear a bit on everyone. People are sleep deprived, and of course a lot of people are on edge, and then people in the local area, especially the farmers, have now got to contend with dealing with destroyed livestock, no fencing, and finding feed for livestock. So, and then of course in between all that, I was out the other night on a strike team and in Talangata Valley, and they're watching fires like 24/7. There was a bunch of farm utes with slip-ons in a paddock, and they're just sitting there all night watching the fires up.
That was Ian Travaskis.
Hi, my name's Joe. I'm from the Kilpinya Volunteer Fire Brigade, and you are listening to the Country Hour.
G'day, my name's Charles Geary. Welcome back to the NT Country Hour. Time is 5 minutes past one. That means it's time to have a look at the weather. With me here this afternoon is Billy Lynch from the Bureau of Meteorology. Billy, good afternoon.
G'day, Charles.
Now, there was a bit of rain around the northern half of the territory this weekend. Let's have a bit of a look at how much fell over the top half.
Yeah, sure. I can give you the 3 day rain list if you like.
That would be perfect. That would be perfect.
Yeah, so top of the list was up on the Wessel Islands. I won't give you my Richie Beno impersonation, but it had 222 millimetres. So they were quite exposed to the sort of monsoonal showers and storms. But yeah, everywhere else, it was just more the normal sort of non-monsoonal afternoon showers and storms. So across elsewhere in the Arnhem, Croker Island, 119. Groote Island had 85. Across the Daly, and in parts of Kakadu, Cowinda, 105 millimetres. We saw the Pines. Actually, that was the standout, sort of near Pine Creek, 157 millimetres. It's hard to sort of summarise it. Howley Creek, 95, generally sort of 50 to 100s across the Daly. Mm. Darwin Airport had 81, there was 68 at McMinns. And then further south, the rain sort of thinned out a bit. So Beswick Bridge had 49, Nooka Airport 39, and then through the VRD we saw Keep River 41, Bradshaw 27, 15 at Victoria River Crossing, and then 0.4 way down at Yallara Airport.
Thanks for that rundown. But I think later in the week, the big story, it's looking like that ex-tropical cyclone Koji, which is currently in Queensland, it's looking like it's going to cross into the territory. Can you tell us when and where it may affect the NT?
Well, I wish I could. Certainly looking very closely at that. It's a bit uncertain exactly the timing of it, but we are, anticipating the remnants of that tropical cyclone to push across the Northern Territory at some point later in the week. So probably the earliest it would be would from about Thursday, sort of pushing into that northeast Barkly kind of region. But it might be a bit delayed. It could be Friday. It could be not even until Saturday when it's getting into the NT. And then, generally tracking westwards across the territory towards the North Kimberley, sort of into the weekend. Stress that there's a few different scenarios in terms of the timing and the strength of it. But I guess the key message this early in the week is it's probably going to push across. It's probably going to bring an increase in rainfall later in the week and into the weekend.
Now, this is obviously a little over the border, but there's obviously been quite a bit of flooding across the border in northwest Queensland, and that's close to our Barkly region as well, obviously. Is there any chance that affects those flood-impacted regions?
Yeah, yes, is the short story. So we do expect that system to bring renewed rainfall to northwest Queensland, which will just prolong the recession of the rivers. At this point, it doesn't look like excessively heavy, the rainfall through northwest Queensland. So it may not renew or cause renewed flooding. I mean, it may, but what's more likely is it would just sort of delay the recession of the flooding, or recession of the rivers as it stands. And then, some of that is probably going to push into parts of either the Barkly or further north, and there's probably an elevated risk of renewed flooding across the NT later into the week, as I was mentioning. But early days, we just need to sort of see how it tracks throughout the week.
And just looking around for the rest of the day and overnight here in the Territory, what is the forecast looking like for the remainder of the day and the evening?
Yeah, so the risk of any rain, thunderstorms today would be north of about Elliott. This afternoon, evening, expecting another sort of build-up in storm activity. Risk of some damaging wind gusts, so we could reissue some severe thunderstorm warnings later today for that. And then generally south of Elliott, south of about Mataranka, actually, we're looking at very hot temperatures above 40 degrees around Kalkarindji, Lajimanu, getting up to 46 this afternoon. Mm-hmm. We do have heat wave warnings continuing, and urge everyone through that area to just be sensible if you're working out in the sun today. Try and keep out of the sun as much as possible.
Billy, thanks for joining us today on the Country Hour to give us that weather update.
Welcome. Thank you, Charles.
That was Billy Lynch from the Bureau of Meteorology.
Wherever you go, ABC Local Radio goes too. Grab the ABC Listen app now. No ads, no subscription, no worries.
Heading over to northwest Queensland now, where flood water is still moving through parts of the region. Latest numbers from the Department of Primary Industries show an estimated 48,000 missing or dead livestock due to those floods. Now, near Julia Creek, a grazer at Argyle Station, Patrick Hick, is glad to hopefully see the last of the rain at his property, but the full scale of the damage is still unknown. He spoke with Abby Holter.
Look, Abby, the sun is out, so the ground is drying out a bit, which is just letting cattle get up on top of the ground and travel a bit. We're still getting losses from pneumonia. We lost quite a lot of cattle to pneumonia, and that's ongoing, but it's starting to slow down a little bit, but certainly cattle are still very knocked around. We've been spending quite a bit of time up until yesterday just pushing cattle into their watering troughs and making sure they're getting out, getting a feed, getting a drink, which they were sort of not doing for themselves. I guess they were a bit shocked from the event. So we've been doing that, just basic animal husbandry. But it is getting a little bit better every day for us. There are plenty of people still on the river proper who are still in the thick of it, and the peak has not passed them yet, and they've got cattle standing around in deep water and trying to keep them alive. So we're past the worst of it, but there are plenty of people who are not. The flood peak is still moving downstream, and it's got a long way to go. And while I'm saying that things are getting better for us, there are other people out there who the worst is yet to hit them.
It is early days and it's hard to predict, but what sort of percentage of cattle loss are you predicting for you guys?
Oh, look, it really is early days, Abby. Until we muster, we're almost guessing. I mean, it's significant, and I can tell from flying around that we're going to be well north of 1,000 head of branded cattle, but other than that, I can't tell you much, really.
How do you think that you and your community are feeling at the moment?
Well, there's probably two things going on there. There's the sort of the shock and grief, the distress of seeing your livestock die around you is extremely hard to go through, and that's sort of, at the moment, that's what most people are going through. They're not thinking about the financial consequences yet. It's just the distress of seeing your livestock die around you. That's the low point. The high point is the amazing job that our community has done, doing what they can to save livestock. And it's it is so uplifting to see what people have done and the resourcefulness of people. It's quite amazing. We always knew we had a good community, but gee, it is really, the message is really rammed home to us in these sort of events.
Travelling east, Grazier at Sutherland Station, 120 kilometres northwest of Richmond, Nico Lord says he's grateful his stock losses will be significantly less than what was seen in 2019.
We've come through quite well. We were in a good, strong position going into it. We had a green pick over probably 70 or 80% of the place, and that's probably been the big difference from 19. We had more rain this time round. You know, some gauges, we're a bit unsure really. We had a couple of gauges that overflowed twice in between checks on them. So, you know, that's 500 mil there plus a few other smaller ones we've tipped out. But generally speaking, we sort of had 450 to 550 over the place. And unfortunately, that country that didn't have a pick was probably some of the higher end of the rain gauges as well out to the west. We've copped a few losses out there, but you know, in the grand scheme of things, compared to some of our friends sort of for the south and for the west, very, very minor. But for us, you know, we went into it with very good body weight, and we were a bit more prepared this time with getting country cattle up onto higher country, and we're very fortunate to have some limestone ridges which are well buffled, and so it was, you know, it was lot similar to 19 in terms of the volume of rain and the time frames, but we had a bit of green pick. We didn't get the cold snap. The river, the Saxby River that comes through us, was significantly higher than 19 for us. We had a 500 horsepower wheel dozer sitting on the waterline of where the water came up to in 19, which we thought was pretty safe, and it went a meter underwater this time. A few new records broken like that around the district.
Is it a sense of relief almost that knowing that you've had so much water come through but the outcome is not going to be the same as 2019?
Yeah, it is. We went into it a lot more confident just because we had better grass and, you know, that bit of pick and whatnot. 19 was tough. You know, it was early February and we hadn't had a break, and, you know, that wears on your body condition on the cattle, and then for them to stand there in mud, you know, you don't get a green stem. You don't get a green leaf growing very quickly. And so 19 was tough. It was tough. They just stood around in mud for days on end. And even though they stood around in mud for the same amount of time this time around, they had a little bit more fat in the system and a bit more grass in front of them. And that all adds up to help a lot.
Grazier at Sutherland Station in the northwest of Queensland. Nico Lord speaking with Abby Holter. Now, this is the NT Country Hour. My name is Charles Geary. The time is 16 minutes past one. It's now 17 minutes past one. But it's not just been pastoralists and graziers impacted by wild weather in Queensland, but cane farmers along the North Queensland coast are also currently feeling the impact from ex-tropical cyclone Koji. The system ended up crossing much lower than first expected, first crossing the coast near Eyre and Bowen, about 100 kilometres south of Townsville, yesterday morning, with the rain heading further south. Kevin Borg is a cane farmer from the south of Mackay and said although the weather system was unpredictable, the region was ready for the rain.
Yeah, so we've had 183 millimetres in the last 24 hours, 48 of that was during the night last night. We had another 80 mils on Saturday night in that 24-hour, that previous 24 hours. So getting quite wet around the place right now. So we'd probably like to see a period of sunshine. Let the creeks go down and things start drying out.
How are the creeks looking in the ground at the moment?
Yeah, look, down our way here, it hasn't been real heavy rain, but it's been very persistent. I mean, at times it did get heavy, but it's been persistent rain and, I guess, soaking rain to an extent. So it's probably going to dry out over the next week if we can get a break. But if we don't get a break and some more heavy rain, I think with the ground saturated now, it will make an impact on those systems, on those river systems.
They expected that this tropical cyclone to hit a lot higher. What sort of preparation, you know, went in your region? Were people kind of less prepared because of those predictions that were made earlier on, or how did that look for you?
Look, I think people are always conscious of it, and we do prepare. I mean, myself here, I did make sure that everything was tied down and nothing was could be blown around. But as far as water goes, there's not a lot you can do to abate any sort of water intrusion. So, yeah, look, we do take it seriously. There's no doubt about that. However, I guess once the cyclones are that high, you probably don't take it as seriously. But one of these days, you don't take it seriously, we're going to be sorry, I guess.
And will this have any impact on your farm at all? Any worries of washouts or damage to the cane at all?
Oh, look, at the moment, I don't feel there is much damage down this way. However, when the water goes down, we'll probably get out and have a look around. There's a lot of water flowing around still. It's just started raining at this minute now again. So, yeah, look, once it goes down, we'll have a look, and hopefully there's not a real lot of damage around, and sunshine comes out. The crop can keep growing. The crop's done quite well up until now. We haven't had any wind down this way. Well, I should say we've had very little wind down this way that was damaging. So, yeah, if we can get that good fine weather, I think the crop will do well from here on in.
That was Mackay cane grower Kevin Borg talking about the impact of ex-tropical cyclone Koji. Time for a song, I think. And let's play someone who's arguably been the biggest country music star of about the past decade now. It's time for some Luke Combs. That was Beer Never Broke My Heart by Luke Combs.
G'day, Tony from Tarina, Darwin and Mackerel Online. I am a second generation commercial Spanish mackerel fisherman, and I'm also a shop manager for our seafood shop. And you're listening to the Country Hour.
My name is Charles Geary. This is the Northern Territory Country Hour. Time is 24 minutes past one. Now, the commercial fishing sector thinks it's going to be a pretty challenging year for the industry. The barramundi fishers are still working through the phase-out of gill nets, which was first announced by the previous NT government in 2024, nearly 18 months ago now. Another big talking point among fishing crews is the ongoing management of depleted fishing stocks of golden snapper and the closure of the Channel Point fishery. NT Seafood Council CEO Daniel Capps says these issues could make 2026 a tricky year, but the industry is still maintaining a positive outlook.
We have to be optimistic, otherwise there's no point in doing what we do. I think it's one of those things about primary producers, whether you're a fisherman or a farmer, that you're always optimistic about the future ahead. But that's not to say that next year will not be without its challenges. There's a number of advisory groups and fisheries management issues that really should have been gathering momentum in the last year, and that simply hasn't been the case. We'll be pushing for a far more proactive response from the Northern Territory government.
Are you referring to the phase out of gill nets?
That's one of them. So really, we've got three big ticket items along with a number of other kind of challenges that face the industry. So I would say that the three big ticket items would be certainly the advisory group around the phase out of gill nets, the recovery plan for the golden snapper, and dealing with the closure at Channel Point in the coastal line fishery, and then progressing the offshore snapper fishery, which is currently being handed over to the Northern Territory from the Joint Authority, which was a collaboration between the Northern Territory and the Commonwealth.
Well, I figure we'll tick those issues off one by one, maybe. The phasing out of the gill nets, I understand, was sort of announced in 2024. Do you think we'll see movement on it this year?
Certainly the advisory group, which brings all the sectors together to put their positions forward, has finally been convened towards the end of last year. And we're hoping to get some instruction from the minister moving forward.
Given the stocks in Darwin Harbour and Channel Point are low and there's an ongoing management process happening there, do you watch what happened in WA with the banning of demersal fishing? Do you watch that with some sense of trepidation here in the territory?
Yes, I think trepidation is a bit of an understatement, but yes, absolutely. I think what really needs to be brought to light here is that we have agreed harvest strategies and we have robust systems in place to manage fisheries. So when we talk about the jewfish over at Channel Point and we talk about the golden snapper, we shouldn't really conflate those two stocks. And the reason I say that is that a harvest strategy has a trigger and it says, if you hit this trigger, then you must do X and Y. That happened at Channel Point, and so there's been a closure, and there will be a closure of about 6 months, I believe it is, to allow those stocks to recover. Golden Snapper, they hit that trigger point some 15 years ago, but successive governments have been reticent to take the action to remedy that fishery. Really, what should have happened is they should have had a short closure 15 years ago, but it's a very unpopular decision to make. And that brings me to the point that really lies at the root of many of the challenges we face, is that the harvest strategies have these trigger points, but it only applies to the commercial sector or the fish and tour operators. Bizarrely, our legislation means that you then have to ask the minister to make the same decision with regards to the recreational sector. And so that puts the minister in a very awkward and invidious position, because you're now asking the minister to make a fisheries management decision. And, you know, through no fault of the minister, he then has to look at that from a political perspective.
That was the NT Seafood Council CEO Daniel Capps speaking to Tom Robinson. Now, before we leave you this afternoon, we've just got some news coming out of Tamboran. The gas company has a new CEO. Todd Abbott says he'll take the reins over on Thursday as the company continues to develop its Beetaloo assets. The company told the ASX that told about the decision this morning, with Mr. Abbott having decades of experience in the industry. His base salary is $550,000 US per year, and he'll be in the role until at least July next year. Now, that's all the time we have for on the NT Country Hour today. Thanks for joining us at the start of the week. Look forward to talking to you again tomorrow. Thanks for joining us.